The Pat Kenny Show
with Matter Private Network
on News Talk.
Thank you, Andrew. From presenting his first radio show at the age of just 12 to chairing Question Time for a quarter of a century, my next guest has chronicled a life in broadcasting in his new book, which is called Keep Talking. David Dimbleby, good morning.
Good morning, Pat.
It's an interesting beginning to your book because I would have thought of you as a patrician, an intellectual, but you tell me virtually in the first paragraph that's precisely what you're not.
Well, I confess I didn't get a very good degree at Oxford University. I had a lot of fun, but I got a third. And in those days, a third was something that you got by not working but being bright enough to be given a degree. So it's kind of double-edged sword, really. Intellectual, but by intellectual, I'm not an intellectual now. I'm not stupid, but intellectual's a different world, you know, where you think simply about ideas, I've always been dealing with more practical things and on Question Time with people's problems and issues, politics, you know, and elections and those kind of things, which are not intellectual exactly. I mean, intellectual is much more in the clouds than that. I'm rather down to earth, really. Mm.
You went into the family business. Your father, Richard Dimbleby, was a hugely celebrated broadcaster.
Yes.
But was there the advice, as Mrs. Worthington was given, not to put your daughter, in your case, son and younger brother, on the stage, or rather, don't put them into broadcasting?
Well, I think it was, actually. I don't know this directly. My mother told me after my father had died that he was a bit wary that I'm going in as a young man might queer his pitch, but then he very sadly died when he was only 52. But he certainly never talked to me about how to broadcast or sort of schooled me in broadcasting. On the contrary, he wanted me to be a lawyer or diplomat or something like that. Though what I learned about broadcasting, I probably learned from watching him do it, but we never talked about it at all, except, oh no, he did once tell me, don't shuffle your feet around when you're on air. It looks as if you're sort of restless. Mm. That's the only advice he ever gave me in the whole time. But, you know.
Don't shuffle your feet while you're...
Well, I was doing a chat show on television and I kept wriggling around in my chair. But no, I think, I mean, I think in an odd way that I sort of learnt about broadcasting by watching him broadcast, but without ever talking to him about it or asking him about it. You know, I use the analogy, if you're a son of a butcher and you go in on Saturday morning and help do the meat, you know, you pick up butchering just by osmosis. I think a bit like that, probably.
You were fortunate, I suppose, to be neighbours with John Logie Baird, who I discovered from your book, not alone was the inventor of television, but he was looking way ahead to high-definition television way back then.
Yeah, I know. He was a proper scientist. He had real vision. He just, by chance, actually lived in the flat above us in London, in West London, in Sheen. And my mum asked him down for, you know, have a cup of cocoa, just the beginning of the war it would have been, or just after I was born. And so he came along and she said, will you kiss my new son goodnight? So I think he's like the fairy at the bedside. Whether he's a good fairy or a bad fairy, I don't know. I think, looking back on it, probably I was rather lucky. He blessed me with a kiss.
Now,
no, isn't that strange? It's a strange thing.
It is strange that the grandfather of television should give you a goodnight kiss, which kind of was like a benediction for all that lay ahead for you.
Yeah, yes. Little did we know.
Little did they know. No. Your book is a kind of a love story with the BBC.
It's
about arguments, it's about falling out, it's about making up, it's about disappointments. But fundamentally, you adored the BBC.
Fundamentally, I've never been on the staff of the BBC, I have to say that. I've always been a kind of freelance employee, but I've always loved working for the BBC for a very kind of simple reason, which is it wasn't a business trying to make a profit for its owner. It was an organisation funded by the people who are forcibly funded, it has to be said. They have to pay their license fee, which is, you know, contentious. But it was, its only purpose was to serve the public. It didn't have any commercial instinct of any kind. Well, maybe except to beat the opposition from commercial television. But that I always liked that about it, that it only had this one purpose. Nobody was going to say, you know, the advertisers won't like that, or the ratings will fall and we won't get the advertising. It did what it thought was right. I didn't always agree with what it did, obviously. But so I've always admired it as an institution. And I also think, actually, you know, of all the, a lot of countries have national broadcasters, of course, but I think of all the national broadcasters, it's probably the kind of strongest, and its reputation around the world is something I'm really proud of, and I think it's very important.
I've always thought about our own national service, RTE, that it was blessed in its foundation, because it started at the very beginning of 1962. It was blessed in its foundation by having a bar set by the neighbour, by the BBC, which kind of ensured a standard to which it could aspire if it didn't always get there.
Is that so? Is that really so?
Well, I believe it to be so, that, yeah. You know, had we a different model beside us, we might have had an inferior service. The business of impartiality, was that a shackle on you at times when you'd be interviewing an idiot minister? And you've got to afford him the kind of respect that you might personally want to give to a more intelligent version of a politician.
I can't imagine who you're thinking of, Pat. No, it's not. I think that interviewing politicians is a very kind of specialised field of interviewing, not like you and me talking now. You know, you can say what you like and I can say what I like. But interviewing politicians about policy, my view of it is that you explore their opinions and you put to them all the objections to their views. And even if you agree with what they're trying to do, you put up all the hurdles against it. Mm-hmm. It's a kind of technical exercise. It's almost like a courtroom cross-examination. Your own views don't matter. It doesn't matter how obnoxious you find the person you're talking to, or how much you may disagree with the views. What matters is that the political argument should be exposed. And I think the great curse of the way we do politics now is that we don't give enough time to politicians on the one hand, and they refuse to give us enough time on the other, because everybody says, oh, you don't, nothing in it for you talking for half an hour about your policies. Much better just tweet your views on this, or go on TikTok or something. And I think that debases politics. It's a serious business. Much as you may hate the politicians, it's a serious business. And it's a serious business for democracy. And the people who are engaged in it should, on each side, should respect that and have proper discussions. So impartiality is not a problem at all for me. Impartiality is a watchword.
You have been released from the constraints of impartiality. You can, you know, articulate your own views. In passing in the book, you say, you know, the kind of politicians that you encountered in the earlier days of your career were a notch or two above the caliber of many politicians that we have today.
Yeah, but that's not abandoning impartiality. That's talking about the quality of politicians. Mm. And I think there is a danger. I don't know in the Republic how this pans out, but I think in Britain, or in England, let's say, certainly, one of the effects of this constant being beaten up on social media and all of that, and the sort of strain of your family life and your own personal views and things being constantly challenged and exposed, means that a lot of people are less willing to go into politics than they used to be. Excuse me. And in the sort of post-war years, we certainly had and this may be romantic nonsense, but I think we had politicians that were made of sterner stuff than the ones we have today, and were less blown hither and thither by the winds of, you know, the fantasies, really, of who's up and who's down as decided by social media. As you know, it's just a different world now. And they're surrounded by so many advisors now. They didn't have advisors constantly saying, go on Question Time, don't go on Question Time, give an interview here, don't do that, don't do this. Politicians used to decide for themselves what they did. And now the whole PR machinery of politics has become so speeded up, it's almost hysterical, really, that you say something and, you know, within minutes you're under attack and then having to defend yourself and then under attack again. And it's kind of political chaos. And I'm not just speaking about what's going on in Westminster at the moment, which clearly is political chaos, but it just politics generally has become frenetic in that way that doesn't allow serious, considered views to come through in the way that I think they used to.
The nature
does that make sense? Does that make sense to you?
It does indeed. And I was going to come to Brexit because, you know, we had very sophisticated debates on this island about Brexit, even though
yes,
the outcome in Northern Ireland was to vote against Brexit. But of course, it was the United Kingdom's vote that was carried. We had quite sophisticated debates about Brexit and its impact on the two islands in various ways. And often the debates in Britain were not as sophisticated as we might have hoped.
I don't know. I don't know what the debates were like. I mean, the thing is, it became so vicious, really, the argument about Brexit in Britain, that it was difficult to, looking back on it, to decide whether it was a properly conducted debate. I mean, there's a lot of argument that, you know, organisations like the BBC were anti-Brexit and Brexit showed that people were out of touch and all that sort of thing. I'm not sure. I think the arguments were very much rehearsed, whatever you think of the result. And the issues that people felt strongly about were not necessarily the issues that an elite felt strongly about. So they were more about, for instance, immigration than they were about the state of the economy, the effect of changes on the economy. So it's difficult to pin down. I mean, I was in Question Time right through that time, and we certainly consistently had these arguments, and we did set piece debates with, you know, Cameron on the one hand and whoever it was on the other. I can't remember.
Was it Jeremy? It probably was.
No, it wasn't. I can't remember. We did a huge debate. That's right. On the eve of the vote, we did a debate in Wembley Stadium, for goodness sake, with sort of 5,000 people. Well, we said there were 5,000. It may have been 3,500. Let's call it 5,000. Huge stage, and three people on each side. Boris Johnson was one, actually, and Andrea Leadsom on the vote leave. And on the stay, we had I can't remember who we had, actually. We had the Mayor of London, Sadiq Khan. And we had, goodness, what's that noise all the time? Mm-hmm. Sorry, I don't know. Did you hear a funny noise?
No, we're hearing you absolutely
loud
and clear.
Anyway.
But the point really about all of that is, you know, many of us felt looking at the murder of Joe Cox, that was an opportunity for Cameron to cry halt. You know, this has gone far enough. But he didn't. He went ahead. And now we live with the outcome. Over the years, the nature of interviewing politicians and particularly prime ministers has changed. I mean, you write in your book about Macmillan's first interview, where he, I suppose, just blundered on, making several mistakes.
Yes. Well, he was very aloof about all that. And politics has changed. I mean, people weren't used to being interviewed. I think Robin Day's interview, I admired Robin Day's style of interview. I don't know whether you ever saw him, but he was
Bow tie was his signature.
Bow tie was his signature, and cross-examination like a lawyer was his technique. And reading Hansard every morning so he knew what everybody had said. So when he came to interview Macmillan, this was the first time. I remember years later, I sat, when Macmillan was about 95 or something, I think I sat at his feet at some reception. I said, what did he think of television interviewing? Oh, never, no trouble with that. I said, what do you think of Robin Day? said, oh, it never bothered me, he said, in a very aloof way. I mean, it was a different era, and he was very clever, Macmillan, but he just sort of brushed away the questions that he was asked. And then did say rather touchingly that he was, that he'd stand down, you know, we'd all like to give up these heavy burdens, which I don't think he did mean to say. But compared with interviewing Thatcher, for instance, now Thatcher was a real challenge to interview and really interesting because she took interviewing seriously. She got nervous before doing her interviews. She prepared for them. And we used to do a 40-minute live interview on Panorama every year. I must have done 3 or 4 with her. And she really engaged, you know. She wouldn't let you get away with things. She'd turn the conversation her way if she could. She'd do, you know, she was really interesting to talk to. So that's rather gone too, yeah. I think, that style of conviction politician who is prepared to listen to questions and answer them.
And the prime ministers in between that you would have encountered, Tony Blair, you write about, Gordon Brown, John Major, who succeeded Margaret Thatcher. What did you make of them? Because they're the three I've actually met. I met Mrs. Thatcher briefly in Brussels and got a question in to a press conference, but yeah, that was a fleeting encounter. But the other three I've met at some length and found them deeply intelligent and empathic.
Yes, yes, you're quite right. I think that's fair. I mean, John Major got an awful lot of stick, didn't he? But he was, he's a clever man. I mean, he just inherited an absolute mess in the Tory party and everything was turning against him. Gordon Brown equally is clearly a very formidable politician, but he just couldn't get it across. You know, he's not good at empathy in public. I mean, during that crisis 2008, he was great, you know, and he did pull the world together then. And Blair has an unbelievable talent, really, to engage the public. Of course, completely came unstuck over Iraq, and has never been forgiven in Britain, I think, over Iraq, even though now he's trying to make a comeback as sort of sensible Labour, new policies and things. But I don't think Blair will ever be listened to, really, again, in the way that he was.
The monarchy, we've seen the changing of the guard, the Queen is dead, long live the King. Do you see the monarchy as an important glue that keeps, I suppose, the United Kingdom together, including Northern Ireland? Do you see it as an anachronism, one that will become irrelevant, will become, if you like, the Disneyland that Britain offers tourists?
Well, I would hope it wouldn't be the Disneyland. And I think the instincts that, for instance, in the coronation in 1953, to set up, you know, fantastic spectacle with the Queen's coronation, I don't think, I mean, I have no idea what they're going to do, but I don't think that will happen with Charles. You know, a coronation on that scale, I think, would be seen to be too flamboyant, really, for current times. Constitutionally, it's interesting, of course, because we don't know what's going to happen in Northern Ireland. We know the connections with part of Northern Ireland with the monarchy, and we know the connections of Scotland and Scotland wanting a whole raft of Scots wanting independence, wanting to keep the monarchy, and, you know, there's a lot of confusions how it goes. But actually, as a constitutional device, I think the monarchy will survive all of these things, because as a constitutional device, to write a new constitution and become a republic really is beyond, you know, not beyond the wit of man to do that, but I think there's no appetite for it. And as long as I was reading a very interesting biography of Edward VII last week, so I was thinking about monarchy, and Edward VII was interesting because he constantly interfered with politicians, tell them, you can't do this, you can't do that, but always backed down when they said, oh, no, we're going to do it. It's quite funny because people talk about Charles having a lot of opinions and, you know, da, 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 and he says, no, it's different being king. And I think, well, you know, it's a cipher job, actually, being king, as the Queen showed. You know, if you do it properly, people don't actually know your opinion about things. You're just there. And that's how the Constitution works. Mm. I mean, there are people who envy your Republican constitution, admire your presidents. But I don't think the idea of this very kind of complicated government arrangements we have in Britain, what with devolution and all the rest of it, the idea of that then being turned into a kind of Republican form of government, I think, is very unlikely. You know, they can't even abolish the House of Lords, for God's sake.
Yeah, finally, David, I should ask you about your thoughts on what's going on at the moment with a mini budget that goes badly wrong, Britain struggling to do trade deals, its place in the world. On the one hand, you know, the Ukrainian president admired everything that Boris Johnson was able to do for him. On the other hand, some derision about the way the money matters have been handled. What is your take?
Well, my take is that this is a leave aside Ukraine and certainly leave aside Boris Johnson, that we're in a position of turmoil, which... because of the speed with which these money matters happen. I mean, it was very well described by a former banker today as the government put its foot on the accelerator of the economy and the Bank of England has put its foot on the brake at the same time. And we know what happens if you ever have had that happen to you in a car. It's happened to me where you put your foot on both pedals at the same time and the whole thing comes to a grinding halt, and it's a disaster. So, but that said, monetary movements are often very fast resolved. So I think, my God, my fingers are crossed because the predictions of how this could go wrong are dire. And I have no idea what the future of Truss and Kwarteng is. I mean, there seems to be some rebellion on the back benches of the Tory party already. So I don't know how that pans out. I mean, it's certainly quite extraordinary to have a new prime minister come in and then face this chaos within a matter of weeks. Quite extraordinary. Mm. But, you know, one's lived through political drama. I mean, one of the things you learn about political dramas is, you know, they do arrive and there's terrible storms and then things kind of settle down again afterwards. So I just pray that happens.
All right. Well, David, it's a wonderful book. I enjoyed it enormously. It's called Keep Talking, A Broadcasting Life. It's out now in hardback, published by Hodder & Stoughton, and its author, the legendary David Dimbleby. David, thank you very much for joining us on the programme.
Pat, thank you. Very good to talk to you.
The Pat Kenny Show.
With Matter Private Network.
Weekdays at 9 a.m. on News Talk.